Hello and welcome. My name is Lloyd Borrell. My mission is sharing solutions and raising awareness so that we can all live a happy and healthy life in our electromagnetic world. Today, I'm thrilled to have as my guest Arthur Furstenberg. Arthur Furstenberg is a scientist, journalist, and author who is at the center of a worldwide movement to reduce electromagnetic pollution. He's the author of several EMF books, including The Invisible Rainbow, A History of Electricity and Life. He's the founder and president of the Cellular Phone Task Force, and he's the administrator and co-author of the International Appeal to Stop 5G on Earth and in Space. To date, the appeal has more than 140,000 signatures from over 200 countries and territories, including over 3,800 scientists and 2,000 medical doctors who've signed this appeal. So today we're going to be talking about Arthur's inspiring work, which he's been doing for unbelievably 37 years, because he sent me his photo and he just doesn't look that old. And also his book, his most recent book, The Invisible Rainbow, which is an amazing book, and what we can learn from that. And also this 5G, you know, 5G, which we talked about before, but this the movement that Arthur has started here, why he started it, and how we can all contribute to this movement, and also Arthur's personal solutions, what he does for dealing with EMS, because he's got his own story too here, of course. So Arthur is based in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and you can contact him through the website 5gspaceappeal.org. That's all one word, 5gspaceappeal.org. Arthur, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure to have you on. It is. So, you were injured by an X-ray overdose some years ago, quite a few years ago, which cut short your medical career. Can you talk us through that? Start there. Just, you know, tell us what happened and how it changed your life.
Yes, I was on my way to being a doctor. I was in, in the summer after my second year of medical school, I had a root canal procedure. And the root canal was successful, but in other words, the procedure was successful, but the patient almost died. They couldn't find anything wrong, but I was quite ill. So they redid the root canal procedure several times, gave me full mouth X-rays, put me through a lot of procedures over the course of a couple of months. And over the course of a couple of months, I had 40 to 50 dental X-rays. And during the last X-ray, I was sitting in the dental chair, and he turned it on, and I felt something give way in the back of my skull, and I felt an electric current pass through me from head to toes, which scared the dickens out of me. And then the next morning, I went back into the hospital, and I could feel electrical currents from every piece of electrical equipment in the hospital. And then I proceeded to lose my memory and my ability to function in medical school. I was 30 years old and did not have Alzheimer's disease. But I took a leave of absence for 9 months, and during that time, I had the tooth extracted, which gave me immediate relief from all of my health problems. And I returned to school, except things were not the same, because I still felt electricity from every single piece of electrical equipment. And it made me quite ill. And after a few more months of that, which was approximately after 3 years of medical school, I collapsed with all the symptoms of a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I quit school. So that is the brief history. But before I did that, I started my research. And I made a deal with my attending physician on surgery. My plastic surgery professor permitted me to be excused from the operating room, which made me extremely ill, in exchange for writing a paper, a research paper on a topic of my choice. This was in 1981. So I wrote my first paper on this subject. I went to the library and discovered that there was an enormous amount of research on the effect of electromagnetic radiation. And I wrote a paper called The Effects of Radiant Energy on Living Organisms. And that was the beginning of my research on this topic. The year was 1981.
Yes. And your symptoms today, are you still reacting to electrical equipment today in the same way as you were back then in 1981?
Actually, yes. It affects most severely my heart and my ability to think and remember and various other things. But yes, absolutely. In order to remain a reasonably functioning individual, I have to avoid exposure to EMFs as much as possible.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about what you do because obviously you're still here, so you found a way of, you found certain solutions for dealing with this. I'd like to talk about that in a little while. But I'd just like to sort of, so I'd like to go back. So 1981, this thing happened to you, or 1980, or whatever it was, nearly 40 years ago. And this thing happened. And if you just kind of take your mind back to that time, my question is, this happened, and so obviously you were in a state of shock, I imagine, when it happened. And then you started doing this research. You wrote this initial research paper, which was the first of many. And what was it, you know, what were you thinking at that time when you did this research and you discovered that, you know, there was all this research on it? You know, what...
I was shocked that we did not learn about this in medical school. That was the most shocking thing to me. I went to the medical library at my school, which is University of California, Irvine, and there were a whole bunch of shelves full of books on this topic, and they weren't teaching it to us.
Hmm. And imagine you spoke about this with your friends and your doctors, you know, fellow doctors. What was their reaction?
Actually, the only thing I did initially was write that paper. Yes, I spoke about it with my attending physician. Close friends knew about it, but basically, I had never heard of this problem before. I had never heard. The summer before I started medical school actually was when I first became aware of anything to do with energy fields. Before that, I didn't even know they existed. I had never, from the time I left medical school in 1981, it was another 8 years before I met any other individual who said they were electrically sensitive. So this is something that I did not talk about to anybody. After a few years, I completely recovered my health and I forgot about it, essentially. Except that I knew I had to practice some avoidance, but I didn't pay attention. I communicated with Robert Becker, who wrote The Body Electric, and I continued some research on my own, but no, I didn't talk about it to a lot of people until the end of that decade, when it became unavoidable, because computers were taking over the world at that point. And in 1990, the place where I was working became completely computerized, and I could no longer work there. And when I tried to find another job, I discovered that this had already happened in most other workplaces, and that I was essentially unemployable. And that changed my life, and that's when I joined a support group in New York City, and started to become acquainted with the fact that there were a lot of other people who were affected both by chemicals and by electromagnetic fields. So that was my education. It was during the 1980s.
Yeah.
And then in 1996, I read in the New York Daily News, this was the summer of 1996, the headline was 3,000 city lampposts are about to become part of the wireless revolution. And this was before anybody owned cell phones, but the telecommunications industry was planning on making digital cell phones available for Christmas. And the plan was to put base stations on top of lampposts, 3,000 of them in New York City. I knocked on Telda Levy's door. She was in my support group, and I gave her the article, and I said, "We've got work to do," and we started my organization, which was the Cellular Phone Task Force, and that was the beginning of my activist career. I'll continue that story a bit, because when the first base stations, the 2G, what we now call 2G base stations, which was the first digital cell towers, came to New York City on November 14th, 1996, within 1 week, I was almost dead.
Yeah.
I was not aware in advance of the date that it would be turned on, and when I investigated, holy cow, that was the date when I suddenly became dizzy and nauseous, and within a few days I was not eating, and I was not sleeping, and my head was roaring. And I could not, my skin was so sensitive, I could not stand to be touched. And on the seventh day, my vocal cords slammed shut three times during the night, and I couldn't take a breath in or out. I grabbed my sleeping bag, got on the Long Island Railroad, went out to a park that I knew about on Long Island, and camped out there for 3 days, and the relief was unbelievable. And I, my nephew lent me his car, and eventually gave me his car, and I drove up to Norwich, New York, which is a small town in upstate New York, and I made that my home for a couple of years. And meanwhile, Telda and I and a third person, we put an ad in a free newspaper in New York City. This was the antennas. The first 600 antennas were turned on November 14th. In December, we put an ad in the paper. If If you have experienced any of the following symptoms, beginning approximately November 15th, 1996, we need to hear from you. And we heard from them. Hundreds of people, all walks of life, men and women, all races, professionals, non-professionals, doctors, lawyers, airline employees, teachers, everybody. They had suddenly thought they were having a stroke or a heart attack or a nervous breakdown on about November 15th, 1996, and this was the beginning of my organization. And
so one day later, literally it's within 24 hours, people were being affected.
Yeah. Suddenly, on that day. A complete cross-section of society. And then I went to the Centers for Disease Control, and I consulted with Dr. Goldsmith in Israel, who used to be in California, because I was told he could help me document the epidemiology of this. So he sent me to the Centers for Disease Control, which publishes weekly mortality statistics for 122 cities in the United States. And I correlated that with the day that a particular provider had provided the first digital cell phone service in that city. And beginning on exactly that day in every city, which was a different day for every city, the mortality in that city increased 10 to 25% for the next 2 to 3 months. That was true in my city, in New York City, it was true in Chicago, it was true in a lot of other cities.
Is that research published?
I published it in my in No Place to Hide, which was a journal that I used to publish between 1999 and 2004. And also, the graphs from that research from the CDC are in the last chapter of my book, The Individual Rate, the Invisible Rainbow.
Okay.
So this was not just a matter of a few electrically sensitive people. And today I no longer focus on the issue of electrical sensitivity as such, because what does electrical sensitivity mean? It is a term that still to this day is undefined. It was not created by the medical profession. This was a term that patients who realized why they were sick applied to themselves. And nobody has ever defined it. So what happens is people that have managed somehow to discover what is making them ill and are stubborn enough to insist on it despite the denial of everyone else's society, those are the people who label themselves electrically sensitive or electromagnetically hypersensitive, whatever the EHS is the commonest term. But as I discovered in 1996, this affects a broad spectrum of society. And we're not abnormal. We just are somewhat more susceptible than the rest of the population, but everybody's being affected, whether they know it or not. And if you go actually look at the surveys that have been done, a heck of a lot of people, a lot more people get sick from EMF than the people who call themselves electrically sensitive. It's it depends on what your questions are as to what percent you get. If you ask, are you sensitive to electricity, the answer comes back 3, 4, 5%. If you ask, does your cell phone give you a headache, the answer sometimes comes back 75%. So it depends on what questions you ask. If a cell tower is built near your home and you go around and you ask, how are you sleeping, most people are not sleeping anymore. So it's a peculiar term for a problem that affects actually the entire population.
So your book, your latest book, The Invisible Rainbow, was published 2 years ago, A History of Electricity and Life. There's a lot of research in here. It's very, very deeply researched, very well referenced. And you really go back, it's a history of, isn't it, this electricity. It's not cell phones particularly. And you go back in time to look at how electricity, the first, various first experiments with electricity, and the
starting
conclusion.
Beginning in 1746, Michael.
Right. And so we can say that it appears, electricity, it's always been dangerous, has it not? There's always been dangers. People have not necessarily known these dangers, but right from the beginning, the dangers were there.
In the beginning, it was widely accepted that electricity had something to do with the life force. And so they should have realized that it was dangerous, because it is dangerous to play around with your life force. By the time the 19th century rolled around and the electric battery was invented and people started to use it for technological purposes, people forgot that electricity had anything to do with life, and society went into massive denial, and we have pretended for the last 2 centuries and more that electricity has nothing to do with life, does not affect biology, does not affect the environment, and we pretend that we can use infinite amounts of it without any consequences, and this is about to destroy our world, and that is why I wrote The Invisible Rainbow. And that is why I am devoting 24 hours a day right now to try to stop 5G. Mm. There are people all around the world that are working to stop 5G, and I happen to be in the middle of it with this worldwide appeal, the international appeal to stop 5G on Earth and in space. And we have more signatures from more countries than anybody else, and trying to figure out what to do with it. It's still a relatively small percentage of the population.
For people that are listening that don't know what 5G is, can you, so it's the latest generation cellular technology, but why is 5G particularly a problem?
Because until now, there has been some restraint on wireless technology infrastructure. That cell towers, for example, have been subject to land use regulation. They have been subject to exposure limits by the various authorities. In the U.S., it's the Federal Communications Commission. In Europe, it's the ICANIRP. In Russia, it's something else. All the limits are different, but they've been subject to some limits. And there's been some consciousness that you don't want a cell tower very near you. Suddenly, a lot of things have changed. 5G was designed to facilitate what's known as the Internet of Things, which means there's going to be, if they roll this out completely, there's going to be antennas in virtually everything anybody owns. And they're predicting that every individual is going to have antennas or of some sort in 60 devices or objects that they own. Their appliances, their refrigerators, their milk cartons, their baby's diapers, everything's going to communicate with each other without human intervention. Your milk carton will order milk for you as soon as it's out of milk. It's like half of this is going to be for driverless cars. And in order to machine-to-machine communication, appliance to smart meter communication, everything. So in order to make this possible, the industry needs much more bandwidth than is currently available at the spectrum that we're using. So they have gone up to a much higher frequency. It is the millimeter wave spectrum, and 20 gigahertz up to 60 gigahertz. There are plans to use up to 100 gigahertz. And to use this enormous amount of bandwidth requires 10, 100 times as many cell towers. You cannot supply this amount of bandwidth using the existing infrastructure. So, and millimeter waves, these very short wavelengths, are blocked by objects very easily. They don't penetrate walls easily. They're blocked by trees. They're blocked by buildings. Each cell tower, in order to use that much bandwidth, can only serve a maximum of 20, 30 people. If they want to maintain the speeds that they want. So the plan is to put small antennas, because the millimeter size antennas are the size of millimeters. So you can cram 100, 1,000 millimeter size antennas into a small box. And this is what they're doing. That they're putting small, inconspicuous antennas on top of existing infrastructure, lampposts, utility poles, traffic lights, and the prediction is that we're going to have an antenna on the sidewalk in every city in the world, in front of every third to fifth house. This is an incredible change from what currently exists. So the changes are, number one, the density of towers. Number two, the proximity to houses. Number three, the very much higher frequency. Number four, they're going to be in phased arrays. And the phased array was invented for radar purposes. If you put 100 or 1,000 antennas inside a radar facility and make them work together, they can focus a laser-like beam to aim in one particular direction. So what these antennas on utility poles outside your house are going to do is they're going to have 100 or 1,000 millimeter-sized antennas in them, which will focus very narrow pencil-like beams at every user device, a separate beam for every device. So if you're holding a 5G device in your hand, a cell phone, that device will also have a few dozen antennas, millimeter-sized antennas, and they will focus the beam, and they will track the nearest cell tower. The nearest base station, the cell tower, will track your device as you move, and they will aim a focus beam at you. So that's a change. The fifth or the sixth change is that the FCC and the ICNARP and all the other regulating authorities have relaxed their exposure limits, or standards, not the exposure limits, but the emission limits for millimeter waves. such that handheld or user devices, including handheld devices, will be allowed to emit up to 20 watts. This is what the FCC now allows. Whereas previously, your existing 3G or 4G device is not allowed to emit more than about 2 watts. So that's a tenfold increase in radiation. The antennas, the little tiny antennas on lampposts, which look inconspicuous, are now allowed to emit 30,000 watts per 100 megahertz of frequency.
Wow.
Again, at least a tenfold, a hundredfold increase in power. So suddenly, the radiation levels all over the Earth are going to be 10 to 100 times larger than they were last year.
Why so much power?
Because
of this?
Penetrate your walls and get into your house.
Right, there's a penetration problem. Hmm.
And the reason that our international appeal is called the International Appeal to Stop 5G on Earth and in Space is because this is going to happen mostly in cities and populated areas and suburbs and maybe some rural areas, but it's not going to happen on in forests or oceans or very remote areas. So SpaceX is in process of launching 12,000 satellites to provide 5G from space. And Amazon, a couple of months ago, said, well, we're going to launch 3,000 satellites and have our own fleet from space. And then we have OneWeb, which is, I think, has permission to launch 4,500 satellites. In total, we have projects underway that are going to put up 20,000 satellites to blanket the entire Earth with this same 5G phased array, millimeter wave technology from space. Also, extraordinarily powerful because these focused beams will be, in other words, each satellite has the actual power level of maybe a few hundred watts. But if you focus a pencil-like beam at a place on the Earth, it will be the equivalent of up to 5 million watts. And that's what the FCC has given permission for each of these 12,000 satellites to SpaceX. And this is the emergency, and this is why we are circulating this appeal, because we have to get a conversation going between government officials and injured people and environmental organizations and telecom companies, all stakeholders, finally have to sit down at the same table and air this issue, which has never been done in the 39 years that I've been looking at this issue. It's been swept under the rug. For 200 years as a society, we've been in denial that this has any effect whatsoever. The Russians were studying radio wave sickness beginning in the 1940s, but they have more or less forgotten about it since the Iron Curtain fell, and the Russians are doing this too. And this cannot go on because life on Earth is in immediate danger. We already have studies in various parts of the world showing anywhere from 75% to 98% decline in insect populations. We have birds disappearing.
We can't attribute this just to EMS, can we?
Mostly to EMS, yes.
We don't have any studies on that, though.
Actually, we do.
That level of, you know, EMS effect.
When Marconi activated the first permanent radio station on the Isle of Wight in England, within a couple of years, all the honeybees were gone.
Mm.
And this was called Isle of Wight disease, and then people forgot about
that. But then they came
that,
back, didn't they?
They came back, but then there was this phenomenon in all over the world called disappearing disease, for a couple of decades, and then people sort of got used to that and forgot about it, and then it was called colony collapse disorder. In more recent times, in other words, this has been a continuous phenomenon. Yes. The bees on the Isle of Wight recovered gradually over a couple of decades, but then the same phenomenon started to happen elsewhere as radio communications spread elsewhere. We also have study from India showing that when you expose honeybees to a cell phone, within 10 minutes they're not metabolizing their food. Metabolism stops completely. And then within a half an hour they start to get angry and make a lot of noise, and then they start to swarm, and then they leave within an hour. It's like, and people are ignoring it. They're saying, oh, the disappearance of insects, it's due to changes in land use. It's due to pesticides. It's due to climate change. Well, but it's been happening for over a century. Before there was pesticides.
People are talking about everything, you know, with regard to this insects disappearing, to it's blaming on everything except EMFs. That is true.
Yes, everything except EMFs. And yes, land use has changed. Yes, there are pesticides. Yes, there's climate change. But this has been happening for over a century. And EMFs interfere with metabolism, which is such a basic biological function, that it's got to be a major, if not the major, cause of many environmental problems and many health problems, including in human beings, and I devote a chapter to each, cancer, heart disease, and diabetes.
Is that at the core of how EMFs affect us, in your view, that it impacts our metabolism and everything stems from that? Is that what you're saying?
For those three diseases, yes. For neurological diseases, no. For neurological diseases, it interferes with nerve conduction. It interferes with conductivity in the heart. It interferes on the cellular level in other ways, but it also interferes with electron transport in the mitochondria. And if you interfere with metabolism in that way, you're going to interfere with the digestion of sugars, which leads to diabetes. You're going to interfere with the digestion of fats, which leads to coronary artery disease. And you're going to enable cancer to thrive because you're starving the body of oxygen. So that particular effect on mitochondria, on electron transport, has particular consequences. EMFs disrupt the blood-brain barrier. That's another effect, and that has other effects on your brain. It interferes with the perineural sheaths in your nervous system. It interferes with nerve conduction directly. Hundreds of different kinds of effects have been described. And the reason that there are hundreds of different kinds of effects is because we are electrical beings. And electricity is, in some sense, the life force. It has something to do with life, with health, with healing, with growth. The global electrical circuit it travels through every living thing on Earth and interfaces with knowledge that was accumulated in by the Chinese 5,000 years ago, and everybody that does acupuncture knows how electricity circulates throughout our bodies. What is not so well known is that the qi that circulates in our acupuncture meridians connects with the sky, the ionosphere, and with the earth, and the global electrical circuit travels through the ionosphere. It's an actual electric current that atmospheric physicists study that travels from sky to earth, and it travels through the earth, and then it travels back up to the sky during thunderstorms. That's what lightning is. And there are all these fields of knowledge that are not being integrated. In other words, there's atmospheric physics that studies the global electrical circuit. There's power line harmonic resonance, which is studied by intensively at Stanford University. There is Oriental medicine that has that studies qi, which is related or the same thing. It's like nobody's looking at the entire picture. The reason that satellites will be such a disaster is these 20,000 satellites will be in the ionosphere, which is part of the global electrical circuit, which goes through our bodies, and they will be polluting that circuit, which keeps us all alive and which is important for growth and healing. They'll be polluting that with dirty electricity, because you've got 20,000 satellites putting out up to 5 million watts of effective power each of pulsed, digital, modulated radiation.
And Pete, so we can say, this is very simply, this appears to be very bad news, but particularly very bad news for people living in urban environments, because
urban
we've
environments
got these satellites,
yes,
which is blanketing the earth, but people in urban environments, they're going to be particularly affected, are they not? People in rural environments, then if it's coming down from the sky, then because we can actually shield ourselves fairly easily, that's the good news, is it not?
The problem from the satellites is not the direct radiation on the earth. The problem from the satellites is that will drastically alter the electromagnetic environment of the entire Earth. And it will pollute the global circuit. In other words, the wiring in our bodies will be polluted with dirty electricity from these satellites. It will not be the direct radiation on the Earth. It will be the alteration of our electromagnetic environment, which keeps us alive.
Right. And we're kind of, we're in the unknown here, aren't we? We're in the realms of the unknown. We don't really know. So the satellites, if they do go up and if they do switch them on, we don't exactly know what the effect is going to be, do we?
Well, I have compiled evidence, and I will direct people to an article that I wrote, which is on my other website. My article is called Planetary Emergency, and it's available on cellphonetaskforce.org. That's my organization's website. And it gives the... and it has links to data that I published in the late 1990s when Iridium was launched. And Iridium and Globalstar, those are the two satellite constellations presently in low orbit around the Earth that are providing service to satellite telephones. Iridium went into commercial service on, if I recall correctly, September 23rd, 1998. On that day, electrically sensitive people all over the planet became deathly ill. I was one of them. That's why I did the survey. A few days after I became sick that morning, I called up by telephone 50 or 60 different people in six countries. And it was extraordinary. We all became deathly ill, didn't know if we were going to live, some of us, on exactly that date. On exactly that date, there started to be newspaper articles that homing pigeon races ended in disaster. And this happened for the next 2 or 3 weeks. Thousands of homing pigeons never returned home. Some of these articles referred to the fact that birds were not flying in the sky. And I continued to monitor this. When Iridium went bankrupt, when they went back into service, the same thing happened. Except that the second time, what made the newspapers was large numbers of spontaneous abortions and foal deaths among very expensive racehorses in a lot of countries. And that made the newspapers. When Globalstar went online, people got sick. The first time Iridium went online, I also monitored the Centers for Disease Control mortality statistics, and the mortality rate in the United States rose by 4 to 5% for a couple of weeks, reminiscent of what happened in when 2G went online in all these cities. So I've been monitoring this for a long time. Have I proved it yet? Maybe not, but there's evidence, and there's evidence for Iridium with just 66 satellites. If 66 satellites seems to have done that sort of damage, what are 20,000 going to do? Yes. This is what we're worried about.
Yes. So the evidence appears to be strong. But nevertheless, I'm an optimist, Arthur. And it would appear there is some reason for hope here. I mean, there's always reason for hope, is there not? But 140,000 signatures over 200 countries.
Well, actually, now we probably have about 160,000. I think we have over 3,000 medical doctors now. We're accumulating signatures. And I'm an optimist, too. If I wasn't an optimist, I wouldn't be doing my work.
So how is this, how is this, what's going on here? Is it gaining momentum? What's happening? You know, so you've been following this for so long, Arthur, really, perhaps, all the guests I've interviewed, I interviewed Dr. Martin Blank. He's been working on this a long time, but you're certainly one of the people that's been working on this longest. So, you know, how is this changing? Is the movement growing, and how fast is it growing?
The movement is growing quickly now against 5G. 5G is getting people's attention like previous generations of wireless technology did not. There are now protests in regular protests both in the United States, in Switzerland, and the Netherlands, in Australia. I don't know them all for sure. But I'm in touch with a lot of people.
And in the U.S., of course. I mean, people are speaking out and stopping.
A lot of people are speaking out.
Small cells being sighted in certain areas, in certain districts.
There's a lot of conferences going on. There's a lot of anti-5G organizations. When I speak to ordinary people about it, they already know about it. So there is awareness. That is hopeful. On the other hand, the use of cell phones continues to increase. So we have two contrary trends here. We have one trend where people are finally becoming aware that this is harmful. The other trend is that people, in record numbers, are getting rid of their landlines and they're getting cell phones. So nowadays, a large percentage of the people, maybe most of the people that contact me anymore about stopping 5G are calling me on their cell phones.
Yeah.
Many, or most of the people, are not walking the talk. Right. Many or most of the people that are signing the international appeal to stop 5G on Earth and in space, they're signing it on their smartphones. Even electrically sensitive people, some of them who are calling me nowadays for help, they're calling me, they're homeless or they need a place to move because they're so sick, they're calling me on their cell phones. And this is discouraging. Because if people will not give up their cell phones, we're not going to stop 5G.
Yes. And so it's not just a question of signing your wonderful petition. It's a question of actually what you do in your life, you know, in terms of what you spend your money on and how you are using these technologies. And this is where people... So the beginning is... signing your wonderful appeal and other appeals and becoming aware of this, but then we have to actually make changes in our lives, do we not?
We do. We have to give up cell phones.
I can't see that happening anytime soon. But if you
own a cell phone, the infrastructure, all the wireless infrastructure all over the planet has to be there.
Yeah. If you own a cell phone, you have a subscription, presumably, and you are supporting this whole system. You're paying for that tower.
You're paying for it. And in order for your cell phone to work wherever you want it to work, the infrastructure has to be there all over the planet.
Yes. So you're paying, you've got a cell phone, you've got a cell phone subscription, you're paying for all this madness to continue.
That's right. And not only that, but people do not realize that the radiation from their cell phone goes on forever. It's blocked by objects, but at least 4G and 3G and 2G goes through walls. So if you use your cell phone, you're irradiating your neighbors, you're irradiating the person that you pass on the street, you're irradiating the person that you're standing in line at the post office, you're irradiating the person that sits next to you or at the next table in the restaurant.
So like, when you say go down forever, you mean a level that we can't measure? Is that what you mean? Because we can't measure it forever, can we?
Your cell phone, in order to work, has to communicate with a cell tower that may be many miles away. If your cell phone is working off of a geostationary satellite, that radiation has to be received by that satellite 23,000 miles away. That's how far it goes. And every person and every bird and every insect and every living thing anywhere is being irradiated by your cell phone. And the literature, the scientific literature, does not support a dose response. In other words, if you read Robert Becker, if you read Ross Eady, if you read Neil Cherry, I don't know about Martin Blank, but they all said that there is no safe level. And if you actually take seriously the scientific literature, the effects at near zero levels are almost the same as the effects at very high levels. So there's not a dose response. It's not true that if you reduce the power, you make it safer. And it's not true that...
If we reduce the power, then certainly many... people are less impacted.
No, that is not correct. If you reduce the power, you'll make it more difficult to provide cell phone service because of
if you reduce the power, you reduce the exposure level, and if you reduce the exposure level, most people, the REHS, most people I've talked to, and in my experience as former EHS, then you are less affected.
Well, I would disagree with that. That the power, the exposure level is mostly a proxy for coherence. That the further you are away from the source of radiation, the less coherent the waves are when they arrive at you, because there are reflections that, and there is interference here. So the further you are away, the more reflections are added to the direct radiation, the more it is blocked by objects, the more there is diffraction. But if you actually do the experiments and you raise and lower the power levels, you do not find that there is a dose response.
Okay. We're running out of time. It's gone very, very quick.
Yes.
Could you talk about, could you share, please, a little bit about what you do? So exposed to ionizing radiation, by the way, X-rays, so ionizing radiation, we agreed, not the non-ionizing type, when you had this dental work done all these years ago. And here you are
yes.
today. So these obviously impacted you, your body, you know, your health tremendously. And here you are today. I know you're incredibly careful, and we're speaking. That's why you're speaking on a telephone, and I'm actually doing this interview also on a telephone, so that you can hear me. Okay. So in terms of what you've done, the changes you've made. Firstly, you've moved away from these exposures. That was the first thing. Is that correct?
Yeah. The main thing that I do is I avoid exposure. I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And this is a whole other subject. But for reasons of the quality of the earth here. I live in an adobe house, so the earthen walls of my house block the cell tower radiation. But also the high conductivity of the earth underneath Santa Fe is protective. It means that the induced currents from all of the radiation are grounded.
So what kind of earth is that?
They go straight into the earth instead of getting stuck in your body. I don't know.
Is it like limeshale? Is it sandy? Is it?
I actually don't know what kind of soil is. I'm talking about the conductivity down to mid-mantle, like for 150 miles. There's a science called magnetotellurics, where they sound the earth with low-frequency radio waves to determine the conductivity at various levels of the earth. And this is done whenever there's prospecting for oil and gas or minerals. Santa Fe has one of the highest conductivities of anywhere on the planet. And I discovered this by accident when I was homeless and somebody invited me to live here, and I said, "You're crazy. There are cell towers in Santa Fe." They said, "Come try it. What do you have to lose?" And I did, and I felt fine here. So I've stayed.
So that's the most important thing. What you did was moving to Santa Fe, where we've got this high conductivity of the earth. And then, so nutrition. Tell me about that. Are you on a special diet?
I eat only organic food. In fact, I eat only vegetarian organic food, and that's the diet that I feel best on.
Okay. And supplements?
I take no supplements.
No supplements at all?
No.
Okay. And so what about, you know, like lifestyle habits?
I have virtually no appliances in my house. I have nothing digital. I do not have internet in my home. I have an old refrigerator that does not have a digital clock on it. I have a landline telephone only, and I have virtually no other appliances. I do not have a television.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of how you live, how you look after yourself, so beyond the nutrition, a special exercise regime, meditation, tell me what do you do?
Oh, that is also a long story. Yes,
the short version then.
Yes, I am trained in various alternative healing modalities. After I left medical school and recovered my health, I became certified as a Feldenkrais practitioner. I am a certified Rubenfeld synergist. I know how to take care of my body because that was my training. I was a meditator for 10 years. I stopped at some point doing it as a daily practice, but it is part of my life. So, yes, that is an important part of how I live.
When you say it's part of your life, but you're not meditating, so how can explain that, please?
Well, if you've done it for that long, your whole life becomes a sort of a meditation.
Right. So you mean like being in the moment? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Okay. You're peeling the orange. You're peeling the orange, thinking about the orange. Nothing else.
Yeah, something like and you learn how to breathe, and that stays with you, and it's all part of keeping yourself healthy is knowing how to use my body, knowing how to breathe, knowing
breathing is super important. And just a quick tip, somebody who, because we all breathe, yeah, but there's different ways of breathing. There's ways which incredibly powerful breathing is, aren't there? Could you share, something, a breathing technique that you use?
No, I kind of don't use any specific techniques anymore. Just everything that I've learned becomes part of me.
And a resource, perhaps, where people can learn of this technique?
It's not one technique.
That would be a good subject for another paper.
I had a Kundalini yoga teacher for a while. I had a different kind of a yoga teacher for a while. I studied shiatsu and Jinshin Do and polarity therapy. I dabbled in a lot of things before I became certified in two methods. And I've been on a spiritual path since I was a teenager.
And you practice yoga?
I don't anymore. No, life has become a practice. It kind of, when you practice for enough time, it just becomes part of how you live.
Yes, and so you're working with energy every day. Is that what you're saying? With your own energy?
Correct.
And somebody who would, so how much time do you devote to that? Do you have like a specific time, or is it something you do throughout the day?
It's kind of with me throughout the day. If I get into a crisis, then I have to stop and I have to do some movement exercises that I learned, and I have to do some breathing exercises that I learned. I have the tools, but I don't do them as a regular practice anymore.
And somebody who's listening, because this is really important, I feel, because this is another variation of what I do, and I've spoke to other people who are also very, very sensitive and have managed to overcome that extreme sensitivity. So somebody who wants to learn more about what you do, your solution to this, your way of working with energy, where can they learn that?
Oh God, I studied it for many years. I studied how to work with energy with my hands. I studied how to work with it inside myself. It's not something that can be learned overnight.
Okay.
It's not something that can be learned by reading about it. You have to have a teacher.
You have to have a teacher. And a teacher you can recommend?
No.
Okay.
all of the great teachers that I've known, with the exception of Ilana Rubinfeld, yes, I can recommend her if she is still teaching, but she would be 85 years old now.
Okay.
Ilana Rubinfeld was my main teacher.
Yes. Okay.
And she founded the Rubinfeld Synergy Method, in which I am certified.
Yeah.
I believe she still assists in the Rubinfeld Synergy trainings, but I think she's mostly retired. And all of the other teachers, but both in our movement, all of the greats. Robert Becker is no longer with us. Norton Blank is no longer with us. Ross Eady, Neil Cherry, all of the people who knew this field, who knew the big picture. Most of them are no longer with us. Most of the great healers that I have known are also no longer with us.
Mm. And those people that you just cited there, they're big healers, in your opinion? Like Robert Becker?
No, I was talking about the people who were experts on EMS.
Right, okay, yes.
They were not healers.
No.
But they were EMF gurus.
Yeah, EMF gurus. I don't know any other
way to put it.
Yeah,
they were the people that I learned from,
yes.
And they knew this subject.
Yes. Arthur, we're out of time. Very briefly, is there a last message you'd like to share with the listeners?
Throw away your cell phone.
Okay, great. That's nice and short. You have an encyclopedic knowledge of this, very clear. Your book, The Invisible Rainbow, is amazing. I bought it from you when it came out. It's like 500 pages long. It is just, it's just an amazing book. And you have written many other books, I know, three or four other books, and literally hundreds of publications.
I've written actually only one other book.
You've written one other book, I beg your pardon. I thought I saw about three on there when I looked through your CV. But hundreds of other one, two, three, Microwaving Our Planet. Okay, twice, that's correct, published twice. Amazing speaking with you. And people obviously have to go to, apart from just throwing away their cell phones, have to go to your website, which is 5gspaceappeal.org, sign it, share it with everybody you know. We don't want this to happen. 5G is madness. We need to stop this. There is a movement. It is gaining traction, and people just need to, you know, act on this and start making changes in their life, because it's not just that. They said, we've got to start somewhere. Everybody's got to start somewhere. But, yeah, it's so important that people share this information. So, Arthur, thanks so much for attending today. Wonderful work you're doing, and please carry on.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Thank you, sir. And if you're looking for solutions to deal with EMFs and their effect on your health, this interview and all my previous interviews are available in the EMF Expert Solutions Club, with full transcripts. Information is on my website. In the next episode, I'll be interviewing another expert, so watch your inbox for details. My name is Lloyd Borrell from electricsense.com. Thank you so much. Have a great day. Take care. Bye-bye.